You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the additional $600 a week in unemployment benefits from the CARES Act have expired. We'll take a look at how that could affect Wisconsin's overall economy. First, every 10 years, the U.S. conducts a census. That's the constitutionally mandated count of households in the 50 states and in U.S. territories. And like so many things this year, the census has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic. And there's controversy about when the in-person count will end. Hanzi Lo Wong is a national correspondent for NPR based in New York City. He reports on the people, power, and money behind the 2020 census. Hanzi, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what is at stake with the census and why it matters that they get it right.
When we're talking about the census, we are talking about power and we are talking about money. We're talking about how many congressional seats each state gets, as well as how many electoral college votes each state gets for presidential elections, as well as each community's share of some $1.5 trillion, with a T, dollars a year in federal tax dollars used for public services, including Medicare, Medicaid, and schools and roads.
In a normal census year, and this is not a normal year, I think, in any way, but what's the normal timeline for the census being sent out, then the follow-up, and then pulling these results together?
You know, before the pandemic hit, the Census Bureau was planning to have finished all counting efforts last week, January or July 31st. Should have been the end of door knocking and collecting responses online at my2020census.gov through the toll-free numbers as well as through the mail. We're at a point right now that the Census Bureau is still collecting those responses and is just now ramping up door knocking, and it is supposed to now end on September 30th.
There had been a longer extension before that, right?
The Bureau was planning in April. It announced that it was planning to continue counting through October 31st. This was part of a completely revised timetable for the Census Bureau. Because of all the delays, the Census Bureau said it could no longer meet the current federal legal deadline, which is by December 31st. The Census Bureau, through the Commerce Secretary, oversees the Bureau, has to present to the president the latest state population counts. Those are the numbers used to determine each state's share of congressional seats. The Census Bureau said in April it can no longer meet that deadline and that it needed Congress to pass new laws to extend those reporting deadlines, to extend December 31st into next year, April 30th, 120-day deadline extension. And the Bureau has been operating as if it would receive those extensions. It has not. Only Democrats so far have introduced legislation in Congress to extend those deadlines. No laws have been passed. And in the meantime, recently I confirmed, broke the story, that door knocking was going to end earlier than expected. And now we know that the collection of online phone and mail responses is going to end earlier than expected. September 30th is the new end date.
Is there a concern that taking that month off at the end of that extended deadline is going to mean not everybody gets counted?
There are major concerns that that is what's going to happen, because we're at a point where roughly 4 out of 10 households around the country have not been counted yet. And these are households that are likely going to be households from communities of color, from renters, a lot of renters, a lot of rural residents, groups that have been historically undercounted each census decade after decade. And what that means is that the workers on the ground around the country getting ready to do that door knocking at households that haven't responded yet, they have a much harder job because they're trying to do this in-person contact with a shorter timetable in the middle of a pandemic and also in some parts of the country in the middle of hurricane season. So it's unclear how much time actually the door knockers have, because the next few weeks are going to be very unpredictable with the pandemic still going on and also with this hurricane season brewing up. And it's unclear if all these households that haven't filled out a form, will they be able to be reached by the Census Bureau? And what that means, if they're not able to be reached, is the Bureau will have to rely on statistical methods, methods that have proven to overrepresent the white population while underrepresenting Black people, Latinx people, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, Native Americans. And that is going to have devastating consequences in federal funding, political representation for the next 10 years.
Talking to Hanzi Lo Wong, correspondent for NPR. He reports on the people, power, and money behind the 2020 census. And we're talking about the effort to bring the census in on time and accurately this year. Hanzi, do we know why that month got trimmed off at the end of this?
It is unclear. The Census Bureau says it's under directives from the Commerce Secretary. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the Census Bureau, was appointed by President Trump and says that they are trying to meet these current this legal deadline of December 31st, reporting to President Trump the latest state population counts. But what's interesting is that as early as May, career officials at the Census Bureau said that they could no longer meet that December 31st deadline. So the Census Bureau now is rushing to meet a deadline that career officials already said they can no longer meet. So it's unclear exactly what is driving this pressure. This says the White House, I've tried to ask, does it still support the Census Bureau's request for these deadline extensions? Gotten no answer from the press office. And again, in April, President Trump publicly supported these deadline extensions and now has seemingly gone silent. In the meantime, coronavirus relief package is being negotiated, and there are questions of whether or not that will be passed in time to include deadline extensions, and that may revise, force a revision of the timetable all over again.
Is there any indication that there's a ramping up, hiring, I don't know, extra census workers or getting a bigger PR campaign to try to get people to fill out the census online?
The Census Bureau says it's trying to do all of the above, but it is facing really, really tough challenges, especially because of the pandemic, where you have folks who have signed up and waiting to take on these jobs. They need to get trained. They need to get fingerprinted. But all this often has to get done in indoor areas, in closed spaces, at a time where we're trying to socially distance and a lot of public health concerns about the spread of coronavirus. There are a lot of folks who are now showing up to these trainings. And I've heard from some folks who have said, I'm not going to go forward with this. They don't feel comfortable. They don't feel safe. And the Census Bureau is trying to provide enough PPE, as well as require that door knockers keep 6 feet of distance, at least when trying to conduct these in-person interviews, that they cannot be conducted inside a person's home, has to be done outside a person's home. All of these measures are being taken to try to mitigate and trying to overcome these challenges. But again, this is an extra layer of complication in an already really tough job, trying to get the what the Census Bureau considers the hardest account groups, groups that are not likely to trust the federal government and have are very wary of giving their personal information. Now you have on top of that public health concerns.
If I'm a state or local official, I guess I have a vested interest to try to get everybody counted to make sure, you know, our area gets the fair share of federal money, for example. Are state and local governments in any way stepping up efforts, given that they're already under a budget crunch because of coronavirus?
You know, it depends on where you are in the country. There are many states and many localities that are that have been running lots of outreach campaigns, some doing their own door knocking, not waiting for the Census Bureau to send out its own door knockers to try to drum up interest and boost participation. But it really depends on where you're talking about in the country, whether or not local governments have and state governments have put forth those dollars to really fund that type of outreach. There are also community groups that have been trying to do that around the country. And right now, we're going to see how effective all of that outreach is going to be. Again, around 4 out of 10 households, roughly nationwide, have not participated yet. And it's going to be to see how much of that needle can be moved at this point.
One more controversy surrounding the census. I want to at least touch on the Trump administration issued a memo recently about counting undocumented people and how congressional representation is calculated. What's the bottom line there?
I think we should keep in mind that the Constitution requires the whole number of persons in each state to be counted in order to determine the numbers for redistributing seats in Congress. That's what the 14th Amendment says. And also the fifth sentence of the Constitution also notes that it's persons that should be counted for the census, no mention of citizen, for example. However, President Trump has issued this presidential memo issued it last month calling for unauthorized immigrants to be excluded from the apportionment count. Experts that I've talked to say that that policy cannot be carried out because it is not legally possible to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the apportionment count because the census form does not include any question about a person's immigration status, which means the Census Bureau is collecting information without knowing whether any of the people they're collecting information from, what their immigration status is. So the Census Bureau would have to then rely on records and come up with estimates using statistical sampling. And that is statistical sampling. The Supreme Court has already ruled is not allowed in the apportionment count. You can't use numbers that involve statistical sampling when redistributing seats in Congress. Supreme Court has ruled on that. But all of this is part of multiple lawsuits that I'm tracking. And we'll see how this plays out. And as we get closer to when those numbers are delivered to the president.
Ansi, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Ansi Lo Wong is a national correspondent for NPR. He joined us for an update on the status of the 2020 census and what the effect could be if there is a significant undercounting of U.S. residents. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin economist about the immediate and long-term impacts of the expired CARES Act unemployment benefits. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration isn't accepting new applications for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program, despite a Supreme Court ruling that stopped the program from being closed down. We'll talk to an expert on immigration law about where things stand now. First, the additional $600 in unemployment benefits passed through the CARES Act have expired. As lawmakers in Congress decide on whether to reinstate the benefits or lower them, we'll take a look at their impact on Wisconsin's economy. Logan Kelly is a professor of economics at UW River Falls. Logan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Indeed. Thanks for having me.
Well, these payments lapsed at the end of last month, a little before the end of the last month. What kind of immediate individual impacts are you watching for since they've shut down?
Well, in the immediate, we're going to start to see increased missed payments. So things like credit card payments, utility payments, rent payments. And that has the short-term impact of, number one, incurring additional fees. So going from owing a little bit to owing even more, as well as risking things such as utility shutoffs and evictions. So in the near term, one of the things I would be most worried about are increased food insecurity, particularly for amongst children. As well as increased housing insecurity.
That's the effect, the immediate effect on individuals. Do you see this having, given that we've got this higher than usual unemployment, do you see this having ripple effects throughout the wider economy?
Of course, because we have a segment of the population with now less disposable income, they're going to be spending less. And as a result of spending less, that reduces overall economic activity. Lowering income for a wide range of businesses, especially some of our small businesses.
Yeah. Do you worry about, I mean, even apart from this, are you worried about losing a lot of those small businesses in this tough economic time?
Well, yes, indeed. Part of the issue that we want to think about in terms of recovery from the pandemic once we get the virus under control is how much of that economic infrastructure, so to speak, do we lose? And when we lose a small business, we don't just lose the mom and pop bookstore that's on the downtown. We lose a viable business that's employing people where the managers of that business have gained both the connections, so the connections with banks and sources of financing, sources of suppliers, so supply chains, and sources for employees. They've gained all that knowledge, so all that human capital then is lost, and it takes time for that to build back. We lose that business. We may never get a particular business just like that back. Well, okay, in the long run, maybe that's not a big deal. But the issue is, in the medium run, we have no business there, and it takes time for a new business to come in. So if we want speedy recovery after the COVID pandemic is over with, we really want to try to smooth out or bridge that gap for as many individuals and businesses, particularly small businesses, as we can.
Right. We saw things like the Paycheck Protection Program and other efforts to help businesses bridge the gap there, especially ones that had to shut down completely, like, you know, restaurants and bars. Did you see that having an impact? Do we still need that kind of thing now?
Absolutely, we need that kind of thing now. In particular, one of the things that we can look at is there's always going to be a time frame between an employer looking for a new employee and an out-of-work worker finding that job. So there's this search process that goes through. If we can skip the search process and simply keep the connection between the employee and the employer, that recovery or that restart once we get the virus under control is going to be much smoother and much quicker. On top of that, when we think about this kind of search mechanism, there's some longer run impacts that can happen due to this lack of the lapse in the $600 unemployment benefit, in that when the person loses or misses the payment, that can affect their credit ratings. And that's one of the pretty standard screening methods for employment. It affects what you pay for different products like insurance. It also affects whether you're able to get future financing. Say they want to go start a business, it would affect their ability to do that. And so it's more than just the short run impacts that we're seeing. We're going to see long run impacts that are even more significant if we can't bridge that gap, both for individuals and businesses.
Talking to Logan Calley, professor of economics at UW River Falls, about the end or lapse, depending on how this all shakes out, in enhanced unemployment benefits at the federal level. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Steve with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, one of the challenges we're looking at right now is that we have a debt load that is just incredible. And that $600 pandemic payment, I did the math right when I was looking at our employees at my company. If you're making, I believe it was about $23 an hour or less, you were better off being on unemployment in the state of Wisconsin. But with that being eliminated, a lot of these people are going to go back to work. And if you don't, what the guest is advocating is just borrowing from our kids' future to pay for people who don't want to work. So can the guest please comment on that and reconcile how that's in the best interest long term?
Steve, thanks for the call. Before you respond, I want to give a listen to a Republican senator from Ohio, Rob Portman, talking to CNBC along the same lines. Here's a listen.
Because it's already a disincentive to work, the $600, but it certainly creates an additional disincentive as the economy begins to reopen even further and there's more and more demand for labor.
So this extra money, a disincentive for people going back to work, Logan.
You know, at some point it might become so. Currently, I don't see it as, I really just don't see that. In the month of July, we had, we have nationwide 16 million people unemployed. I'm not going to say all of those people are not going back to work because of the $600 benefit. The issue is we have fewer jobs than we have people seeking those jobs. And until we see the economy start back up, and we're not going to see a full startup of the economy until the virus is under control, it's just not going to really be a binding constraint. Once we get the economy going, then yeah, I agree. There is certainly theoretical issues with it for certain segments of the population. But let's also keep that in perspective. You need to make approximately $48,500 before anyone who makes $48,500 or more in the state of Wisconsin is actually going to see a pay reduction if they're unemployed and then unable to and on unemployment benefits with the extra $600. So anyone making less than $48,500 approximately, and I won't dispute the caller's more exact calculation, there is a point where below which you will make a little bit more. But if we do a little basic math in estimating basic cost of living in the state of Wisconsin, you need about $33,600 a year to be able to support both paying for taxes and paying living expenses if you live in an average two-bedroom apartment, which in the state of Wisconsin costs somewhere between $750 and $800 a month. At a wage of that amount, if you go on unemployment with a $600 benefit, then you'd have approximately $260 extra a week, more than what you made before. Well, first of all, I know very few people who wouldn't rather work, even though they are going to make, would make a little more money on unemployment. Second of all, we've seen in the pandemic various issues where we have increased costs. For one thing, if you're unemployed, you may be out of your, you may be out insurance. And so your healthcare and air costs may go up fairly significantly. So I really don't see that as a particular disincentive as of yet. In terms of the debt load, one of the things that's really been almost fortunate or almost a silver lining around this, I'm not sure it's appropriate to call it a silver lining here, is that the national savings rate, so private savings, has skyrocketed. So in the month of the last month that was recorded, I believe it was July is the data that's out, the savings rate was 19%. In the month of June alone, private savings was $3.3 trillion, which is enough to offset even the biggest plan that has been put forward so far. So essentially, at this point, even though we've had some questionable fiscal policy over the last couple of years, we're kind of going to get away with it because of national savings has gone up such that it won't be the kind of inflationary pressures that we would worry about in more normal conditions.
Logan, in our last minute, what are you watching for next?
I'm really watching for I'm really keeping close eyes on vaccines. So when we get to a point where we can really, truly, safely reopen and get back to a more new normal, that's really when we're going to see true economic recovery. But in the near term, we have to remember that expectations and genuine fear is motivating a lot of consumer decisions right now. And when we look at second quarter GDP basically cratering the way it did, I prefer to use the year over year because it looks a little bit better at 9.5% loss year over year. We see having consistency in policy. So not having lapses in a $600 benefit is much, much better than, oh, we have this benefit, but we don't know if it's going to go through until the pandemic is taken care of. We really need to have some consistency and, to the extent that we can, reduce the amount of uncertainty in people's lives so that there isn't as much fear.
And we'll have to leave it there. Logan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's economist Logan Kelly from UW River Falls. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call gives his reaction to federal law enforcement agents working in Milwaukee, voting and election laws on the eve of primaries, and other big issues facing the state. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Department of Homeland Security isn't accepting new applications to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program, which shields people from deportation if they were brought to the country illegally as children. The Trump administration has tried to end the Obama-era program, but in June, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked its attempt to do so. Last month, a federal judge ordered DHS to restore the program to its original form. Acting Homeland Security Chief Chad Wolf has said the administration is keeping the changes in place as it considers its next options to end the program, which it considers unlawful. Hiroshi Motomura is a professor of law at UCLA, specializing in immigration law and citizenship. His books include Immigration Outside the Law. Hiroshi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Can you remind us, it's been a while since we've talked about DACA, remind us what it means for the people in the program. What do they receive? What do they not get?
Well, DACA is a program that grants a temporary reprieve from potential arrest and deportation. And as you said, it applies to people who are brought here as children. That's why it's called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It gives them a two-year periods of so-called DACA protection. It can be renewed after 2 years. And with it, under pre-existing law, anyone that has the status is eligible for a work permit. It costs money to apply, but this is the program that President Obama established in 2012. And this is the program that, as you said, that the Trump administration tried to announce an end to it in September of 2017. And this is the rescission or the ending of the program that the Supreme Court said was invalid. And that, as you said, is a decision that the court issued on June 18th of this year.
What now is the Trump administration and the Department of Homeland Security in particular doing when it comes to DACA applications and renewals?
Well, what it announced is, and as far as I know, this is they're trying to follow through on this, is it had issued a memo on July 28th. So we're really just talking last week. And it did a couple things. One is it announced an end. It announced a start, I should say. It announced the start of a process to evaluate what to do with DACA. It didn't say what it's going to do with DACA in any permanent sense, but it said we're going to start a process to evaluate our options. But it also said that during this evaluation process, the government, DHS, will basically do two things on a temporary basis. One is it will not take new applications. Another is that it's severely cutting back on allowing travel outside the United States for DACA recipients. And the third thing it says is that it said renewals are only going to be for 1 year instead of two. So it's not just the 1 year instead of two, but it's also effectively doubles the cost for applicants. And so that's what DHS wants to do. And what I understand is that that's what it's doing. But we're starting to see challenges in court to what the DHS memo said last week.
I've seen some people characterize these actions from DHS as, in effect, defying the U.S. Supreme Court and this federal judge's order. Is that a fair way to characterize it, or is it more, I don't know, nuanced than that?
Well, it's certainly more nuanced, and this is it's an issue that's going to be going through the courts. I mean, I actually happen to agree on balance, and having thought about different angles on this, that the administration is actually doing things that are essentially inconsistent with, I guess, defying, if you want to use that word, what the Supreme Court did. But I think it's not totally cut and dried. I think I can explain it briefly. The Supreme Court didn't say that the administration couldn't end DACA. In other words, the Supreme Court was very clear the administration could end DACA. But the Supreme Court was also clear that the administration had to go about it in a certain way, what it called reasoned decision-making. And that means that it has to consider the options. It has to say what it's doing about the options, why it's ending DACA. And it has to basically be really candid and transparent about its reasons. And the Supreme Court said to the administration, you weren't transparent, you weren't candid, you were just not doing it right, what they call reasoned decision making. And so the court said, okay, you can go and you can make the decision, you can make the decision to end DACA, but you have to do it in a complete way. And so what it actually did was it restored DACA to the situation it was before 2017. In other words, it restored the original DACA program. And that means a 2 year period. It means taking, you know, first time applications all through this 8 years. What the DHS has done in the meantime is saying, well, we're going to think about what we're going to do in the future. In the meantime, we're going to drastically cut back on what DACA means, and we're going to continue to refuse new applicants. That's what makes it look like, and I tend to agree with this, that that the administration here is saying, while we're thinking about ending DACA permanently, we're going to gut DACA significantly. And I think that goes against what the Supreme Court said, which is that don't make any decisions until you're careful about it and you tell us why you're doing it. It's as if they're saying, we're going to think about ending all of it. And that's what you told us to do. But while we're thinking about ending all of it, we're going to end 50% of it or 75% of it. And that to me strikes me as doing something that the Supreme Court did not allow. Again, the Supreme Court said to this administration, any administration, you can set policy. But this court is very concerned, and I'm thinking particularly of Chief Justice Roberts, is very concerned, not necessarily with the bottom line outcome, but they're very concerned with what you might call good government. If an agency, a government makes a decision, they have to be clear about what they're doing. They have to say, we considered all the options. Here's where we came out. And it has to own up to it so it can be tested in the political arena. And the Supreme Court, particularly Chief Justice Roberts, writing from the majority, said to the administration, you didn't do that. You weren't candid with us. You weren't doing good government. And I think that's a fair way to characterize what the DHS memo from last week did. I'm sorry for the long answer, but it's a complicated issue.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about
it. It's a complicated issue. And a lot of it's a bit in the weeds, but I think it comes down to some common sense.
I wanted to ask about the first time applicants, because they seem like the people most affected here. Who is eligible at this point to be a first time DACA applicant?
Well, here's the thing, as a practical matter, you had to be 15 years old to apply affirmatively for DACA, right? So, and starting in September 2017, we're not taking applications from 15-year-olds. So we have an estimated 300,000 young people who, according to the Supreme Court last month, should have been eligible to apply for DACA. Because remember, the Supreme Court said, you tried to end DACA, that attempt was invalid. We're going to restore it to what it was. And so we got 300,000 estimated people who should have been able to apply all along, should have been able to get the status and work permits. And these are the people who are, of course, tremendously affected by what turned out to be an unlawful rescission. Of course, this is also, there's another group we're talking about too, which is the people who have had DACA and will have 1 year renewals instead of two. But I think that, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of young people who, in a sense, got old enough to apply, but were blocked from doing so by what it turns out to be is an invalid obstacle.
We're talking to Hiroshi Motomura, professor of law at UCLA, about recent court rulings on the DACA program and the Department of Homeland Security saying it's not going to accept new applications and it's going to limit the terms of renewals to 1 year instead of two. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Trump administration's choice to deny new DACA applications? Do you want to see the program continue in its original form, or do you want it ultimately to go away? Would you like to see some kind of agreement in Congress to come up with an answer to this question that's been going on for a lot of years now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Hiroshi Motomura, law professor at UCLA, expert in immigration and citizenship. We're looking at the Trump administration's changes to the DACA program despite a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want ultimately to happen to people who have received these protections under the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals Order from the Obama administration? Do you want it extended? Do you want it to go away? Do you want Congress to take action? And is this an issue that's affected your life? Are you or someone you know protected by DACA, or could they be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Hiroshi, I want to bring Congress into it, because the original DACA order and the Trump administration's response, a lot of this is happening, correct me if I'm wrong, because Congress hasn't been able to arrive at immigration deals on DACA and a whole lot of other stuff.
Right. And that's been true for 10 years or over 10 years. And so what President Obama did was to come up with something that I think was within his power, because he wasn't giving people permanent residence or path to citizenship. He did something that was temporary and partial. But you're absolutely right. In spite of, or alongside, or maybe more important than anything the Supreme Court is doing here, we're looking at what the options are for more durable response, in Congress, and this seems to be at an impasse.
So what do you think the next steps could be to give some kind of a resolution that doesn't just take us through the courts again and again and again?
Well, this is a heavy lift as far as legislative action goes, but part of the problem here is that we have an immigration system that that is inadequate, and a lot of people would agree is broken in a lot of ways. And so the DACA program is tries to give some kind of protection to people who, as you mentioned, are brought here as children. And but the larger question is, there are proposals. There have been proposals to give the DACA recipients green cards, in other words, permanent residence, and put them on the path to citizenship. I think there's a polls show pretty uniformly that there's a lot of support for DACA, because there's a lot of support for treating these young people in a way that gives them legal status. But what's happened is that over the last 8, 10, 15, 20 years, we've had a lot of political tussling over what will happen to these young people, because there was a time, just giving an example, a few years ago, when the Trump administration was pushing for more funding for the border wall. So folks on the political spectrum that want more enforcement, more border funding, part of the deal, I think, that's being proposed in some of these cases from the administration is, we'll give you, we'll turn DACA into something more permanent, but you've got to do other things like fund the border wall. And so what happens is that the DACA program and a permanent solution is being caught up in really being used as, or it is, part of a larger legislative game. And, as, you know, we all know, immigration has become a real center of gravity for politics in this country, especially during the Trump administration. And so that puts the DACA recipients right in the middle of a lot of large political questions. And that's,
I want to bring in a call. I'm going to jump in, Hiroshi, because I want to bring in a caller before we run out of time. Yeah. Ricardo is with us in Madison. Ricardo, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
What did you want to tell us about, Ricardo?
Yeah, I just want to say that I am a DACA recipient, and I'm calling from Madison, Wisconsin. I just want to say that I feel that the end of DACA, would have, if something that they can do, they should just do it. And I feel that if they end it, this is going to bring more civil unrest to what it's actually, what is happening right now. That is also going to bring, it's going to take a toll on the economy. It's going to take a toll on the front workers who are now DACA recipients, who are now doctors, and also the essential workers. This will take a toll on our supply chain. And I feel that if it ends or things tip, that that's going to bring people to protest and to get people exposed. And I feel that we cannot afford to basically play around with those things. And again, like you were saying, now not a lot of people are able to travel, and I agree with you with the border funding. Again, can we afford to build a wall in regards to use that money somewhere else?
Ricardo, thanks a lot for the call. Just a minute left. Hiroshi, Ricardo talking about a lot there, including the possible economic impact if DACA were to go away.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ricardo makes a good point that was actually brought to the attention of the court, which is that there are many, many DACA recipients who are healthcare workers, whom we badly need during the current situation with the pandemic. And so, you know, he makes a good point there. It's also true, of course, that DACA recipients more generally are making great contributions to the economy. This is the reason why a lot of employers are very supportive of DACA. This is, in that sense, a program that, you know, in many respects, business is behind. And so I think that's an important part of the legislative piece of this. And I think a lot of this comes down to coming up with a national, I hope, a consensus and a discussion on how to move forward with from an immigration system that's really quite broken right now.
Ricardo, thanks for calling and sharing your story and your thoughts with us. And Hiroshi, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me again.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor of law at UCLA. He specializes in immigration law and citizenship. His books include Immigration Outside the Law. He joins us today for a look at the Trump administration refusing to accept any new DACA applications and limiting the terms of renewals, despite a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that blocked its attempt to shut down that program. After a federal supplement in unemployment benefits ended last week, many unemployed workers in Wisconsin are starting to see their benefits cut by at least 60%. As Rachel Vasquez reports, that has some agencies that provide aid bracing for an uptick in need.
Troy Brewer says he's been anxious recently. On Monday, he got his first unemployment payment without the $600 federal supplement and weekly benefits. That means he went from getting a little over $850 to just over $250 a week.
That don't even cover my mortgage. So it's just like, now what do I do? Where do I turn? What's going to happen now?
Before COVID-19, he was a cook at Fiserv Forum, where the Bucks play in Milwaukee. He's also a union steward for the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization. At the beginning of March, Brewer worked a total of 3 jobs, all cooking gigs. By the end of the month, they were all gone.
Pretty rough to go from 3 jobs to none and to be unemployed for the first time in over 30 years. It's an eye-opening experience, that's for sure.
Brewer has 3 kids he supports, 2 boys, 1 daughter. And he said the drop in his benefits is going to make it really hard for him to make ends meet.
My main focus is keeping a roof over my kids' head and maybe the lights and gas on.
Patty Habeck is the head of Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, a network of food banks and food pantries in the state. She says now that the $600 payments have lapsed, she expects to see more people coming to their drive-thru food pantries.
We are seeing that that line of cars is getting longer and longer already. So as the weeks go by and families are starting to get into the fall, we know that that number is just going to keep increasing.
Congress passed the added benefits back in March as part of the CARES Act stimulus package, but their debate on another round of assistance blew through the July 31st end date for the enhanced unemployment benefits. President Trump has threatened to take executive action extending the increased benefits, but Habeck says the longer we go with no agreement, the more aid agencies like hers will be needed.
We're concerned, especially as we go into the fall, that if a stimulus package isn't passed soon, that more people will lose access to being able to purchase or self-sustain in their own households or become homeless. And that is a lot more challenging to deal with than to help people maintain until jobs return.
Brad Paul leads the Wisconsin Community Action Program Association. They partner with the state on the Wisconsin Rental Assistance Program, or RAP. The program helps cover the cost of rent for Wisconsinites who've been financially impacted by the pandemic. Paul says he's expecting to see more demand for that program, too.
I think, you know, we're certainly going to see more economic insecurity and people just reaching out to programs like RAP to find some form of relief.
Paul says that before COVID-19, Wisconsin already had a housing affordability crisis.
You take that and then you layer on top of that all the people who, you know, in a lot of cases for the first time are being forced into seeking some kind of public assistance because they can't make do with their income. And we're looking at a rough road ahead when it comes to affordable and low-income housing in this state.
As a food service worker, Brewer says he doesn't really have many options right now. He plans to apply for Food Share, a government program that helps cover the cost of food, but he says that will only help some.
Without that, I wouldn't even be able to feed my kids. So I'm my head's spinning right now. I don't know, like, what to do.
Brewer doesn't think he'll be called back to Fiserv for another 4 or 5 months. And as costs and bills start to add up, he says he knows his benefits now won't cut it. Rachel Vasquez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, this year's presidential nominating conventions will be much smaller scale than planned, but they will include party platforms. A politics expert tells us what goes into those platforms and whether they really matter. Amazon is a huge player in online sales. That's no secret, and many people rely on it even more during the pandemic. We'll look at the company's huge influence and recent concerns about its monopoly level of power. Some high-profile probes are heading to Mars. What are they hoping to find? We'll look at some of the mysteries of Mars and its past, present, and future potential to support life. And in guacamole, or just in delicious chunks, avocados are a big part of the American diet these days, and they're a big business. We'll talk to the author of the new book, Avocado, A Global History. Plus, a new poll is due out early Monday morning on the presidential race in Wisconsin and elsewhere. We'll check it out, that and more, Monday on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 7, Republican State Senator Luther Olson has been at the center of some of the biggest debates in Wisconsin politics over the years, and he's leaving the legislature in January. He joins the show for a look back at his career and what's changed over the years. That's Monday at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk about new tricks and recipes we've been trying in the kitchen when we cook during the pandemic. And you can join in with your latest cooking experiments right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.